the visitant, and in time comes back and sees the corn growing. And it was a boy who had been concerned for his father, who was a hunter but old, and he was thinking, isn't there some other way to get food besides this one? And so it came to him out of his intention. It's a lovely story.
Some other way of getting food than hunting.
Yeah.
But the idea is that this visitor, this figure in the vision, has to die and be buried before the plant can grow from the remains of his body.
That's the main theme. It comes up, almost a duplicate of this one throughout Polynesia, for instance.
Well, there's one in Polynesia about the legend of the maiden Hina. You remember that one?
Well, all of the legends in the Polynesian area have a maiden named Hina, and she's associated with the moon. And the death and resurrection of the moon is a dominant theme.
What happens to her in this legend?
Well, the girl who loves to bathe in a certain pool, and there's a great eel that is swimming around in the pool, and day after day he scrapes across her thigh as she's bathing, and then one fine lovely day he turns into a young man, and he becomes her lover for a moment, and then goes away and comes back again and back again, and then one time when he comes he says, just as the Algonquian visitant, now next time I come to visit you, you must kill me and cut off my head and bury my head. And she does so, and there grows from the buried head a coconut tree. And when you pick a coconut and lift the coconut, you can see it's just the size of the head, and you can see eyes and things and the little nodules that simulate the head.
So what you have is the same story springing up in cultures unrelated to each other. What is it
saying?
Well,
to such an extent that it's stunning. And after years and years and years of reading these things, I'm still overwhelmed at the similarities in cultures that are far, far apart. There are two explanations of this. One explanation is that the human psyche is essentially the same all over the world. It is the inward aspect of the human body, which is essentially the same all over the world, with the same organs, with the same instincts, with the same impulse systems, with the same conflicts, the same fears. There is also the counter theory of diffusion. Now, for instance, when agriculture is first developed, let's say in the Near East or in Southeast Asia, I mean, these are the two big centers in the old world, then the art of tilling the soil goes forth from this area, and along with it goes a mythology that has to do with fertilizing the earth and bringing up the plants, killing the body, cutting it up, burying it and having the plant come. That myth will go with the agricultural tradition. You won't find it in a hunting culture tradition. So that there are historical as well as psychological aspects to this problem.
In all of these stories, there is someone dying, a hero dying, in order for life to appear again. What does that say to you?
Let me tell you one story here. This isn't a story. This is a ritual. It's in New Guinea. And it's associated with the men's societies in New Guinea, and they are horror societies because they really enact the myth of death and resurrection and cannibalistic consumption. And you have the myth there of the buried body and the life coming out of it. You know, this is the basic myth. Now we're going to enact it. So here's this sacred field, the drums going and chants going and then pauses. And this went on for 3 or 4 or 5 days, on and on. And rituals are boring, but they just wear you out, you know, and then you break through to something else. Then comes the great moment. The young boys who were being initiated into manhood were now to have their first sexual experience. There was a great shed of enormous logs supported by two uprights over here. And the young woman comes in, all ornamented as a deity. And she is brought to lie down in this place beneath the great roof. And the boys then, with the drums going and chanting going on, one after another, there are about six boys, have their first permitted or public intercourse with the girl. And when the last boy is with her in full embrace, the supports are withdrawn, the logs drop, and the couple are killed. There is the union of male and female again, as they were in the beginning before the separation took place. There is the union of begetting and death again, and they're both the same thing. The little pair are pulled out, and roasted and eaten right that evening, enacting the myth in its essential character. Can't beat that.
And the truth to
that's
which
the sacrifice of the Mass. One of the wonderful things in the Catholic ritual is going to communion. There you're taught that this is the body and blood of the Savior. And you take it to you, and you turn inward, and there he's working within you.
The truth to which the ritual points is?
The nature of life itself has to be realized in the acts of life. When in the hunting cultures a sacrifice is made, it is, as it were, a gift, a bribe, as it were, to the deity that is being invited to do something for us, or to give us something. When a figure is sacrificed in the planning culture, that figure is the god. The person who died, was buried, and became the food is Christ crucified, from whose body the food of the Spirit comes. There is a sublimation of what originally was a very solid vegetal image. He is on Holy Rood, the tree. He is himself the fruit of the tree. Jesus is the fruit of eternal life, which was on the second tree in the Garden of Eden. When man had eaten of the fruit of the first tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he was, is said to have been expelled from the garden. He had already expelled himself from the garden. The garden is the place of unity. Non-duality, non-duality of male and female, non-duality of man and God, non-duality of good and evil. You eat the duality and you're on the way out. So this tree of the non-duality is the tree of the exit. Now, the tree of coming back to the garden is the tree of immortal life, where you know that I and the Father are one, and the two that seem to become one again. And this is exactly the tree under which the Buddha sits.
The tree of wisdom?
The tree of immortal life, of the knowledge of immortal life. And the Buddha under his tree and Christ hanging on his tree are the same image. They are the same image. The one who has died to the flesh and been reborn in the spirit. This is an essential experience of any mystical realization. You die to your flesh and are born to your spirit. You identify yourself with the consciousness and life of which your body is but the vehicle. You die to the vehicle and become identified in your consciousness with that of which the vehicle is the carrier. Do you understand me? And that is the God. So that what you get in the vegetation traditions is this notion of identity behind the surface display of duality. Identity behind it all. All of these are manifestations of the one. The one radiance shines through all things. The function of art, in a way, is to reveal through the object here the radiance. And that's what you get when you see the beautiful organization of a fortunately composed work of art. You just say, aha. Somehow it speaks to the order in your own life. This is a realization through art of the very thing that the religions are concerned to render.
That death is life and life is death, and that the two are in accord.
You have to have a balance between death and life. They're two aspects of the same thing, which is being, becoming.
And that's in all of these stories?
All of them. I don't know one where death is rejected.
This idea of sacrifice is so foreign to our world today.
Well, the old idea of being sacrificed is not what we think at all. Just consider, I think the great model of sacrifice is the Mayan Indian ball game. You know, they had a kind of basketball game. It was a loop there up in the stadium wall, and the idea was to get this big, heavy ball through that. I don't know how they did it with their shoulders or heads or something or other. And the captain of the winning team was sacrificed on the field by the captain of the losing team. His head was cut off. And going to your sacrifice as the winning stroke of your life is the essence of the early sacrificial idea. There's a wonderful story that I found in the Jesuit Relations. You know, the Jesuits here in the 17th century as missionaries up in Canada and northern New York State and so forth, of a young Iroquois boy who had just been captured by the Hurons, or perhaps it was the other way around, I've forgotten. And he was being brought to be tortured to death. The Northeast Indians engaged in a systematic torture, which would go on for a long time, and the ordeal was to be sustained with a smile without flinching. That was it. That was real manhood. But the boy is brought to this as though he were being brought to his wedding. He is singing, and the people with him are treating him as though they were his hosts, and he was the honored guest, and he played the game with them, knowing where he was going. And the priests describing the thing are absolutely bewildered by the situation. And they say that the mockery of this kind of hospitality for people who are then going to become the brutes. No, those people were the priests. And this was the sacrifice of the altar. And that boy was Jesus, you know, by analogy. And the priest every day is celebrating Mass, which is an imitation or repetition, actually, of the sacrifice of the cross. That's what this priest was witnessing. But then you have it also in the Acts of John, Jesus before going to crucify, the Jesus dance. That's one of the most beautiful passages in the Christian tradition. In the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John Gospels, it simply mentioned that we sang a hymn and Jesus went forth. Well, here you have the whole hymn described in a ring. Jesus in the center saying, join hands and we'll sing and we'll dance. And he says, I am this, I am that, I am so forth, so forth. Amen, amen. Oh, my God, it's grand. And then he walks out to be crucified. When you go to your death that way as a God, you are going to your eternal life. What's sad about that? Let's make it great. And they do.
The God of death is the Lord of the dance.
The God of death is the Lord of sex at the same time.
What do you mean?
It's a marvelous thing. One after another, you can see these gods. Gayday, the god of the death god of the Haitian voodoo, is also the sex god. Wotan had one eye covered and the other uncovered, you see? And at the same time was the Lord of life. Osiris, the Lord of death, and the Lord of the generation of life. It's a basic thing. That which dies is born. You have to have death in order to have life. Now, this is the origin thought, really, of the headhunt. In Southeast Asia, and particularly in the Indonesian zone, the headhunt, right up to now, has been a sacred act. It's a sacred killing. Unless there is death, there cannot be birth. And a young man, before he can be permitted to marry and become a father, must have gone forth and had his kill.
What does that say to you?
Well, that every generation has to die in order that the next generation should come. As soon as you beget or give birth to a child, you're the dead one. The child is the new life, and you are simply the protector of that new life.
Your time has come, and you
know.
Yeah,
well, that's why there is this deep psychological association of begetting and dying.
Isn't there some relationship between what you're saying and this fact that a father will give his life for his son, a mother will give her life for her child?
There's a wonderful paper. I don't know whether you knew that I would love to have talked to this point. There's a wonderful paper by Schopenhauer, who's one of my three favorite philosophers, called The Foundation of Morality. There he asks exactly the question that you've asked. How is it that a human being can so participate in the peril or pain of another that without thought, spontaneously, he sacrifices his own life to the other. How can this happen? That what we normally think of as the first law of nature, namely self-preservation, is suddenly dissolved and there's a breakthrough. In Hawaii, some 4 or 5 years ago, there was an extraordinary adventure that represents this problem. There's a place there called the Pali, where the winds from the north, the trade winds from the north, come breaking through a great ridge of rocks and of mountain, and they come through with a great blast of wind. And people like to go up there to get their hair blown around and so forth, or to commit suicide, you know, like jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, the police car was on its way up the early little road that used to go up there, and they saw just beyond the railing that keeps cars from rolling over, a young man actually clearly about to jump and prepare himself to jump. Police car stopped. The policeman on the right jumps out to grab the boy and grabs him just as he jumped and was himself being pulled over and would have gone over if the second cop hadn't gotten around and grabbed him and pulled the two of them back. There was a long description of this. It was a marvelous thing in the newspapers at that time. And the policeman was asked, why didn't you let go? I mean, you would have lost your life. And you see what happened to that man. This is what's known as one-pointed meditation. Everything else in his life dropped off. His duty to his family, his duty to his job, his duty to his own career, all of his wishes and hopes for life just disappeared, and he was about to go. And his answer was, I couldn't let go. If I had, and I'm quoting almost word for word, if I'd let that young man go, I could not have lived another day of my life. How come? Schopenhauer's answer is, this is the breakthrough of a metaphysical realization that you and the other are one. And that the separateness is only an effect of the temporal forms of sensibility of time and space. And our true reality is in that unity with all life. It is a metaphysical truth that becomes spontaneously realized because it's the real truth of your life. Now, you might say the hero is the one who has given his physical life, you might say, to some order of realization of that truth. It may appear that I'm one with my tribe, or I'm one with people of a certain kind, or I'm one with life. This is not a concept. This is a realization. Do you see what I mean?
No, explain it.
And the concepts of love your neighbor and all are to put you in tune with that fact. But whether you love your neighbor or not, bing, the thing grabs you and you do this thing. You don't even know who it is. That policeman didn't know who that young man was. And Schopenhauer says, in small ways, you can see this happening every day, all the time. This is a theme that can be seen moving life in the world. People doing nice things for each other.
What do you think has happened to this mythic idea of the hero in our culture today?
It comes up in an experience. I think I remember during the Vietnam War seeing on the television the young men in helicopters going out to rescue one of their companions at great risk to themselves. They didn't have to rescue that young man. That's the same thing working. It puts them in touch with the experience of being alive. Going to the office every day, you don't get that experience, but suddenly you're ripped into being alive, and life is pain, and life is suffering, and life is horror. But by God, you're alive, and it's spectacular. And this is a case of being alive, rescuing that young man.
But I also know a man who said once, after years of standing on the platform of the subway, I die a little bit down there every day, but I know I'm doing so for my family. There are small acts of heroism
right.
that occur without regard to the nobility or the notoriety that you attract for it.
That's right.
And the mother does it by the isolation she endures in behalf of the family. Of the
motherhood is a sacrifice. On our veranda in Hawaii, there are little birds that come that Gene likes to feed. And each year there have been one or two mothers, mother birds. And if you've ever seen a mother bird plagued by her progeny for food, that the mother should regurgitate their meal to them. And the two of them, or five of them in one case, flopping all over this poor little mother, they bigger than she in some cases. You just think, well, this is the symbol of motherhood. This is just giving of your substance and everything to this progeny. This should be it in marriage. A marriage is a relationship. When you make a sacrifice in marriage, you're not sacrificing to the other, you're sacrificing to the relationship. And this is symbolized, for example, in that Chinese image of the Dai Chi, the Tao, you know, with the dark and the light interacting. It's a well-known sign. That is the relationship of yang and yin, male and female, which is what a marriage is. And that's what you are. You're no longer this. You're the relationship. And so marriage, I would say, is not a love affair. It's an ordeal.
And
the ordeal is sacrifice of ego to the relationship of the two-ness, which now becomes the one.
One not only biologically, but spiritually, and primarily spiritually.
Primarily spiritually.
But the necessary function of marriage in order to create our own images and perpetuate ourselves and children. But it's not the primary one,
no,
as you say.
No, that's really just the elementary aspect of marriage. There are two completely different stages of marriage. First is the youthful marriage, following the wonderful impulse, you know, that nature has given us in the interplay of the sexes biologically, and in then the reproduction of children. But there comes a time when the child graduates from the family, and the family is left. I've been amazed at the number of my friends who are in their 40s or 50s go apart, who have had a perfectly decent life together with the child, but they interpreted their union in terms of relationship through the child. They did not interpret it in terms of their own personal relationship to each other.
Utterly incompatible with the idea of doing one's own thing.
It's not one's own thing, you see. It is, in a sense, one's own thing, but the one isn't just you, it's the two together. Mm. And that's a purely mythological image of the sacrifice of the visual, visible entity for a transcendent unit, cracking eggs to make an omelet, you know? Mm. And by marrying the right person, we reconstruct the image of the incarnate God. And that's what marriage is.
The right person. How does one choose the right person?
Your heart tells you it ought to.
Your inner being.
That's the mystery.
You recognize your other self.
Well, I don't know, but there's a flash that comes and you something in you knows that this is the one. Hmm?
What has mythology told you about death? What do you think about death?
Well, the way, if one can identify with the consciousness of which the body is a vehicle, and really achieve an identification with the consciousness of which the body is a vehicle, not knowing what it is, undifferentiated consciousness, one can let the body go. I like what I heard of Woody Allen, you know, I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. You can have disengaged yourself from the body and not be there, you might say.
And yet, you know from myth and nature that the body dies. It perishes. It rots. We're back to the beginning of the
book. So you expect it. Growing old. I mean, you know what's happening. The body is rotting. It's dying. It's losing its energy. There's more mass than energy here. And the identification then with the life which in a plant survives pruning, cutting, and even eating, the plant is right back there again, is you might say, a biological image that is metaphorical of this spiritual mystery.
There's that wonderful report of the Indians riding into the rain of bullets from Custer's men, and they're saying, it's a good day to die.
It's a great day to die. They're not hanging on. That's the message of the myth. You, as you know yourself, are not the final term of your being. And you must die to that one way or another, in giving of yourself to something or in being annihilated, actually, physically, to return, you might say, or to recognize. Life is always on the edge of death, always. And one should lack fear and have the courage of life. That's the principal initiation of all of the heroic stories.
What's the central story? Which do you have a story that's central to this?
The Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. The Green Knight, Arthur's court is in session, and there rides into the court on a great big green horse, a giant knight. And the knight says, "I have a challenge. I have an adventure. I challenge anyone here to come down here and take this great big axe and cut my head off. And then 1 year from today, meet me at a green chapel," and he tell them roughly where the green chapel is, "and I'll cut his head off." And the only knight who had the courage to accept this curious invitation was Gawain. And the knight gets off his horse, sticks out his neck. Gawain comes down with his axe, and there's the head. And then the knight stands up, picks up the head, gets on the horse, and rides off, says, "I'll see you in a year." Well, that year, everybody was very generous to Gawain, and he rides off for the year. As the day approaches, he finds himself before a little hunter's cabin, and he thinks he'll ask advice here as to where the Green Chapel is, and tells him, "I've got to be there in 3 days." Then the hunter greets him, and Gawain tells his story, and the hunter says, "Well, it's the Green Chapel. He's just down the way here. It's about a couple hundred yards. And why don't you just spend the next 3 days with us, and we'll entertain you, and then you can go to this adventure." "All right, very well." So the hunter says, "Well, I've got to go out for the day on the hunt." And he says, "You'll spend the night with us, and then in the morning I'll go forth. And in the evening I'll come back, and I'll give everything I will have got during the day to you, and you give to me what you will have got during the day." But in the morning the hunter rides off, and Gawain's in bed, and in comes the hunter's gorgeous, beautiful wife. And she tickles Gawain's chin and invites him to love. Well, he's an Arthurian knight, a knight of Arthur's court, and to betray his host is the last thing that a knight can submit to. So he resists this woman, and she's very, very aggressive, and he's very, very stern in his position. And finally she says, "Well, let me give you a kiss anyhow." So she gives him one big smack, and that's that. In the evening, the hunter comes back with a great haul of game, throws it on the floor, and Gawain gives him a kiss. And they laugh, and that's that. Second morning, a similar event. The wife comes in, and Gawain gets two kisses. And the hunter comes back with about half as much game, and he gets two kisses. They laugh, and that's that. The third morning, the wife comes in. Now, here's a man about to meet his death. He's about to have his head chopped off. A beautiful woman, the last moment, I mean, of the possibility of this wonderful fulfillment. And again, he resists. She gives him three kisses and her garter. And she says, "This will protect you against any danger." The hunter comes home with just one silly, smelly fox, throws on the ground. And he gets three kisses, but no garter. So comes the time now to go and have your head chopped off. Do you see what the tests are of the night here? One is sex, you know, lust, and the other is courage. So he approaches the chapel, the green chapel, with the green knight whom he's about to encounter. And he hears the knight whetting this great knife, this great axe. He comes to it, and the knight is there, certainly, the great big green fellow, and he greets him and says, "Okay, put your neck out there on this block, and I'll chop your head off." And he lifts the axe. He says, "No, stretch out a little more." He does this three times, and then the axe comes down and just cuts his neck a little bit. The Green Knight says, that's the Garter. Well, this is the origin legend of the Knights of the Garter. Here's a knight who really transcended the two great temptations, fear of death and lust for sex and the joys of life.
And the moral?
And the moral is that the realization of your bliss, your true being, comes when you have put aside the what might be called passing moment, with its terror and with its temptations and its statement of requirements of life, that you should live this way.
What is that story about, and I forget where it comes from, about the camel and then the lion, and along the way you lose the burden of youth?
The three transformations of the spirit.
Yeah.
That's Nietzsche. That's the prologue to Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Tell me that story.
When you are a child, when you are young and a young person, you are a camel. The camel gets down on its knees and says, put a load on me. This is obedience. This is receiving the instruction and information that your society knows you must have in order to live a competent life. When the camel is well loaded, he gets up on his feet, struggles to his feet, and runs out into the desert, where he becomes transformed into a lion. The heavier the load, the more powerful the lion. The function of the lion is to kill a dragon. And the name of the dragon is Thou Shalt. And on every scale of the dragon, there is a Thou Shalt imprinted. Some of it comes from 2,000 years, 4,000 years ago. Some of it comes from yesterday morning's newspaper headline. When the dragon is killed, the lion is transformed into a child, an innocent child living out of its own dynamic. And Nietzsche uses the term, ein aussich rollendes Rad, a wheel rolling out of its own center. That's what you become. That is the mature individual. The Thou Shalt is a civilizing force. It turns a human animal into a civilized human being. But then the one who is thrown off the Thou Shalt is still a civilized human being. You see, he has been humanized, you might say, by the Thou Shalt system. So his performance now as a child is not simply childlike at all. He has assimilated the culture and thrown it off as a Thou Shalt. But this is the way in any artwork. You go to work and study an art. You study the techniques. You study all the rules. And the rules are put upon you by a teacher. Then there comes a time of using the rules, not being used by them. Do you understand what I'm saying? So one way is to follow, I always tell my students, follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss?
Your bliss, where the deep sense of being in form and going where your body and the soul want to go. When you have that feeling, then stay with it and don't let anyone throw you off. Have you ever read Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt?
Not in a long time.
Do you remember the last line? I've never done a thing I wanted to in all my life.
Quite a
That's the man who never followed his bliss. Well, I heard that line. I was living in Brownsville when I was teaching at Sarah Lawrence. Before I was married, I used to be eating out in the restaurants of the town for my lunch and dinners. And Thursday night was the maid's night off in Brownsville, so that all the families were out in the restaurants. And one fine evening, I was in my favorite restaurant there. It was a Greek restaurant. And at a table were sitting a father, a mother, and a scrawny little boy, about 12 years old. The father says to the boy, drink your tomato juice. And the boy says, I don't want to. And the father, with a louder voice, says, drink your tomato juice. And the mother says, don't make him do what he doesn't want to do. The father looks at her and he says, he can't go through life doing what he wants to do. Said, if he does only what he wants to do, he'll be dead. Look at me. I've never done the thing I wanted to in all my life. I said, my God, Babbitt incarnate. And that's the man who never followed his bliss. Well, you may have a success in life, but then just think of it. What kind of life was it? What good is it? You've never done the thing you wanted to in all your life.
What happens when you follow your bliss?
You come to bliss. This should be it in marriage. I mean, that's the sense of the marriage ceremony. In the Middle Ages, a favorite image that occurs in many, many contexts is the wheel of fortune. There's the hub of the wheel, and there's the revolving rim of the wheel. And if you are attached to the rim of the wheel, let's say fortune, you will be either above, going down at the bottom, or coming up. But if you are at the hub, you're in the same place all the time. And that's the sense of the marriage vow. You know, I take you in health or sickness, you know, in wealth or poverty, but I take you, and you are my bliss. Not the wealth that you might bring me, nor the social prestige, but you. And that's following your bliss. Now, I came to this idea of bliss because in Sanskrit, which is the great spiritual language of the world, and they know all about it and have known about it for a long time. The transcendent is transcendent. But there are three terms that bring you to the brink. You might say the jumping off place to the ocean. And the three terms are Sat, Chit, Ananda. And Sat, the word Sat means being. Chit means full consciousness. And Ananda means rapture. So I thought, I don't know whether my consciousness is full consciousness or not. I don't know whether my being is proper being or not. But I do know where my rapture is. So let me hang on to rapture, and that'll bring me both being and full consciousness. And it works.
What was your rapture?
Well, it started with Indians, and then it went on into more and more mythological matters and the realm of the arts, music, and when I met Gene, then the dance came in, and this is it. Just stay with that.
And one doesn't have to be a poet to do this. Carpenters do it.
A poet is simply one who's made a profession and a lifestyle of being in touch with that. Most people have to be concerned with other things. They get themselves involved in economic and other activities, or you're drafted into a war that isn't the one you're interested in. And how to hold to this umbilical, you might say, in those circumstances. That's a technique each one has to work out for himself somehow. But most people living in that realm of what might be called occasional concerns, they all have the capacity that's waiting to be awakened to move to this other place. I know it. I've seen it happen in students. A wonderful way of teaching we had at Sarah Lawrence, where I taught for 38 years, I'd have an individual conference with every one of my students at least once a fortnight for half an hour or so. And there you're talking on about the things that students ought to be reading, and suddenly you hit on something that the student really responds to. You can see the eyes open, the complexion changes, a life possibility has opened there. And all you can say to yourself is, I hope this child hangs on to that, you know. They may or may not. But when they do, they've found a life right there in the room with you.
How would you advise somebody to tap that spring of eternal life, that joy that is right there?
Well, we're having experiences all the time, which may, on occasion, render some sense of this, a little intuition of where your joy is. Grab it. No one can tell you what it's going to be. I mean, you've got to learn to recognize your own depths.
Do you ever have this sense when you're following your bliss, as I have at moments, of being helped by hidden hands?
All the time. It's miraculous. I even have a superstition that has grown on me as the result of invisible hands coming all the time. namely that if you do follow your bliss, you put yourself on a kind of track that has been there all the while waiting for you, and the life that you ought to be living is the one you're living somehow. And when you can see it, you begin to deal with people who are in the field of your bliss, and they open doors to you. I say, follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be.
You ever have sympathy for the man who has no invisible means of support?
Who has no invisible means? Yes, he's the one that evokes compassion, you know, the poor chap. And to see him stumbling around when the water of immortal life is right there is really, it evokes one's pity.
Right there?
Hmm?
Right there? You
yes.
believe that?
Yes.
The waters of eternal life?
Right there.
Where?
Wherever you are. If you're following your bliss. I mean, you're having that joy, that refreshment, that life all the time.
This has been a Highbridge audio presentation.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Program 5, Love and the Goddess.
Attressi con persona sel dolce vivia.
So through the eyes, love attains the heart. For the eyes are the scouts of the heart. And the eyes go reconnoitering for what it would please the heart to possess. And when they are in full accord and firm, all three in one resolve, at that time perfect love is born from what the eyes have made welcome to the heart. For as all true loves know, love is perfect kindness. Which is born, there is no doubt, from the heart and the eyes.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Love and the Goddess.
One of Joseph Campbell's most eloquent essays was called simply The Mythology of Love. What a wonderful theme, he wrote, and what a wonderful world of myth one finds in celebration of this universal mystery. Stories of love fascinate the human race, and Campbell made their interpretation one of the great passions of his life as a scholar, teacher, and philosopher. Like a weaver of fine cloth, he spun the tales and legends of love into an amazing tapestry of the human psyche. He gathered his materials everywhere, from the erotic mysticism of India to the Old Testament Song of Songs, from the life of Christ and the teachings of the Ramakrishna to St. Paul and Bernard of Clairvaux and William Blake, Thomas Mann, and many others for whom love was the controlling principle of art. Campbell thought the greatest love stories were told in the Middle Ages, when noble and gentle hearts, as he called them, produced a romantic love that transcended lust. This love between individual men and women, amour, was celebrated by wandering minstrels who sang of what the eyes have made welcome to the heart. It helped create a distinctive Western consciousness that exalted the individual experience of men and women over the authority and traditions of the church and state.
Let's talk about love.
Let's talk about love. Fine.
But it's such a vast subject that in mythology, if I had come to you and said, let's talk about love, but where should we begin, what would your answer have been?
I think my answer would have been the troubadours in the 12th century. Let's begin there.
Why the troubadours?
Well, because they're the first ones in the West that really considered love in the sense that we think of it now as a person-to-person relationship.
You're talking about romantic love?
Yes. It's the seizure that comes in recognizing as were your soul's counterpart in the other person. And that's what the troubadours stood for. And that has become the ideal in our lives today.
What had it been before that?
Well, the idea of love as Eros, the god who excites you to sexual desire, this is not the person-to-person thing, that they're falling in love in the way the troubadours understood it. I have a definition for Eros, the erotic biological urge, as the zeal of the organs for each other. And the personal factor doesn't matter.
Where did Eros come from?
Well, Eros is Cupid. And in India, the god of love is Kama. And he's no Cupid. He's a big, vigorous youth with a bow and a quiver of arrows. And the names of the arrows are such things as death-bringing agony and open up. And really, he just drives this thing into you so that it's a total physiological, psychological explosion that takes place. Then the other love, the Christian love of agape, spiritual love, love thy neighbor as thyself. Again, it doesn't matter who the person is. I mean, it's your neighbor. You must have that kind of love. But the kind of seizure that comes from the meeting of the eyes, as they say in the troubadour tradition, and the purely personal person-to-person thing, as far as I know, it originates as an ideal to be lived for with the troubadours.
You've said that what happened in the 12th and 13th centuries was one of the most important mutations of human feeling and spiritual consciousness, that a new way of experiencing love came to expression.
Yes.
And it was in opposition to that ecclesiastical despotism of the heart.
Yes.
Which required people, particularly young girls, barely out of adolescence, to marry whomever the church or their parents wanted them to marry.
That's right.
And what had this done to the passion of the heart?
Well, to say a word for the other before I do this, the usual marriage in traditional cultures is arranged for by the families. It's not a person-to-person decision at all. And this is true to this day in many parts of the world. This is not to say that in arranged marriages of this kind there is no love. There is a lot of love. There's family love and a rich love life on that level. So in the Middle Ages, of course, that was the kind of marriage that was sanctified by the church. And so the idea of a real person-to-person marriage was very dangerous.
Dangerous because it was heresy.
It was not only heresy, it was adultery. And that was punishable by death. For instance, in the Tristan romance, that's the crucial romance.
Tristan and Isolde?
Yes. Isolde was engaged to marry King Mark. They had never seen each other. And Tristan is sent over to fetch Isolde to Mark. And Isolde's mother prepares a love potion so that the two who are to be married will have real love for each other. And these two youngsters, they think the love potion is wine. And they drink it, and then they're overtaken with this love. But Brangaine, the nurse of Isolde, realized what had happened. She went to Tristan and said, "You have drunk your death." And Tristan said, "If by my death you mean this agony of love, that is my life. If by my death you mean the punishment that we are to suffer, if discovered, which is namely execution, I accept that. But if by my death you mean eternal punishment in the fires of hell, in which these people believed, I accept that too.
That was quite...
That's big stuff.
For a medieval Catholic, because they believed in a literal hell.
Well, these people did.
Yes. So what's the significance of what he was saying?
What he was saying is that this love is bigger even than death, than pain, than anything. This is the affirmation of the pain of life in a big way.
And I would choose this pain for love now, even though it might mean everlasting pain and damnation in hell.
That's right.
And that was a marked change in how people...
Well, that is an... Any life career that you choose in following your bliss should be chosen with that sense. Nobody can frighten me off from this thing.
This is sort of the beginning of the romantic idea of the Western individual taking matters into his or her own hand.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can see there are examples in Oriental stories of this kind of thing, but it did not become a social system. It has now become the ideal, at any rate, of love in the Western world.
Love from one's own experience.
You're right. It's a very mysterious thing, that electric thing that happens. And then the agony that can follow, which is that which the troubadours celebrate, you know, the agony of the love, the sickness that the doctors cannot cure, the wound that can be healed only by the weapon that delivered the wound.
Meaning...
Well, the wound is the wound of my passion and agony of love for this creature. And the only one who can heal me is the one who delivered the blow, you know.
So we often hurt most the person we love and heal the hurt by the love that hurt.
That's something like that. That's the paradox of the job.
What did you mean, Joe, when you said that the triumph of Tristan's view of love and vision of love, this beginning of romantic love in the West, was libido over credo?
Well, the credo, I believe. And I believe not only in the laws, but I believe that these laws were instituted by God, and there's no arguing with God. I mean, these laws are just a heavy weight on me, and disobeying those is sin, and it has to do with my eternal character.
And the libido?
Libido is the impulse to life.
Comes from where?
Comes from the heart.
And the heart is what?
The heart is the organ of opening up to somebody else. That's the human quality, as opposed to the animal qualities, which have to do with primarily with self-interest. Opening up to that which is other is the opening of the heart. And that's as the troubadours saw it. It is the opening of the heart.
I can certainly understand, though, why the church was threatened by this, because how can you have a church if everyone's libido is her own God?
Why not? Why can't the church handle that? If you can sanctify a marriage that has been arranged, why can't you sanctify a marriage where two people have joined each other?
So the courage to love became the courage to affirm against tradition whatever knowledge stands confirmed in one's own experience.
Yeah.
Why was that important in the evolution of the West?
Well, it was important in that it gives the West this accent, as I've been saying, on the individual. That he should have faith in his experience and not simply mouth terms that have come to him from other mouths. I think that's the great thing in the West. The validity of the individual's experience of what humanity is, what life is, what values are, against the monolithic system.
Was there some of this in the legend of the Holy Grail?
Yes. Wolfram has a very interesting statement about the origin of the Grail. He says, "The Grail was brought from heaven by the neutral angels." There was the war in heaven between God and Lucifer and the angelic hosts that sided one group with Lucifer and the other with God. Pair of opposites, good and evil, God and Satan. The Grail was brought down through the middle, the way of the middle, by the neutral angels.
What is the Grail representing then?
Well, the Grail becomes the, what can we call it, that which is attained and realized by people who have lived their own lives. So the story, very briefly, is of this, I'm giving it now as Wolfgang gives it, but this is just one version. The Grail King was a lovely young man, but he had not earned that position. And the Grail represents the fulfillment of the highest spiritual potentialities of the human consciousness. And he was a lovely young man, and he rode forth from his castle with the war cry, Amor. And as he's riding forth, a pagan warrior, the Mohammedan warrior, comes out of the woods, a knight. And they both level their lances at each other. They drive at each other. And the lance of the Grail King kills the Mohammedan, but the Mohammedan's lance castrates the Grail King. What that means is that the Christian separation of matter and spirit, of the dynamism of life and the spiritual, natural grace and supernatural grace, has really castrated nature. And the European mind, the European life, has been, as it were, emasculated by this. The true spirituality, which would have come from this, has been killed. And then what did the pagan represent? He was a person from the suburbs of Eden. He was regarded as a nature man. And on the head of his lance was written the word Grail. That is to say, nature intends the Grail. Spiritual life is the bouquet of natural life, not a supernatural thing imposed upon it. And so the impulses of nature are what give authenticity to life. Not obeying rules come from a supernatural authority. That's the sense of the Grail.
And the Grail that these romantic legends were searching for is the union, once again, of what had been divided? The peace that comes from joining?
The Grail becomes symbolic of an authentic life that has lived in terms of its own volition, in terms of its own impulse system, which carries it between the pairs of opposites of good and evil, light and dark. Wolfram starts his epic with a short poem saying, every act has both good and evil results. Every act in life yields pairs of opposites in its results. The best we can do is lean toward the light. That is, they intend the light. And what the light is that of the harmonious relationships that come from compassion with suffering, understanding of the other person. This is what the Grail's about.
When we say God is love, does that have anything to do with romantic love? Does mythology ever link romantic love and God?
Well, that's what it did do. Love was a divine visitation, and that's why it was superior to marriage. That was the troubadour idea. If God is love, well, then love is God. Okay.
There's that wonderful passage in Corinthians by Paul where he says, love beareth all things, endureth all things.
Well, that's the same business. Love knows no pain.
And yet, one of my favorite stories of mythology is out of Persia, where there's the idea that Lucifer was condemned to hell because he loved God so much.
Yeah, that's a basic Muslim idea about Iblis, that's the Muslim name for Satan, being God's greatest lover. Why was Satan thrown into hell? Well, the standard story is that when God created the angels, he told them to bow to none but himself. Then he created man, whom he regarded as a higher form than the angels, and he asked the angels then to serve man. And Satan would not bow to man. Now, this is interpreted in the Christian tradition, as I recall.